Now, I'm starting.
Okay. Now, first I said that grace is one-way love. Then I said that children who are teenagers or adolescents are in soft reaction formations. So you don't need to be as intimidated as you might think, even though they're physically very scary. Mary and I have raised three, and we're still involved in that. One of the things that, and original sin-wise, teenagers are no different from anybody else. Remember, original sin is simply a theological way of saying that human nature is evenly distributed. That's all that original sin, with those heavy words. It just means that human nature is evenly distributed, so your 14-year-old is just as messed up as you are, and certainly just as messed up as your dad was. So there's no real difference in any substantial way between a 14 or 15-year-old girl or boy and their 39-age-old mother. So original sin is evenly distributed, and they need grace just as much as you. Now, the great challenge of the teenage years came across to me in two incidents that happened. One of them happened in Charleston, and one of them happened in Birmingham. And they happened to you, and I found through this that most families have dealt with one impossible acting out teenager. You don't have to raise your hand, but most families, if they have more than one child, have dealt with one teenager who acts out. I was with these parents, as they often do in the church, please will you help our son? He's dressing in black all the time. All he listens to is Guns N' Roses. He's cutting himself, and he's just miserable. And I tried to help him, and we got on pretty well, this young 14-year-old boy. But one night, he became so outraged at his mother that he pulled out his, don't worry, this is not as bad as it sounds it's going to be, he pulled out his father's hunting rifle and pointed it at his mother in her bedroom. He was so full of adolescent male rage that he pulled out his father's hunting rifle and pointed it at her, at his mother. Yes, Archbishop. Right, yes, absolutely. Okay. This caused the crisis. You may have had this happen with a teenage child. If something happened that really was the definitive crisis. And at that point, the parents had the guts and the courage to really intervene, and there was a whole new work done to help this child. But I didn't really understand adolescent rage until that. You have to understand adolescent boys are extraordinarily angry. That they are just filled with rage. It's part of the evolutionary pattern. And it's part of being a boy, and some of you have boys who do video games. And all you need to do is just actually spend any time watching the material. It's not pornographic for the most part, but it is extremely, overwhelmingly violent, the video games. And these games are played by teenage boys starting at age 12 and going through about age 38. As a matter of fact, Mary, I've booked in an hour after this thing. Now, but it took this incident, I was only about 32, but it took this incident of a young man with a hunting rifle aiming it at his mother. Fortunately, he didn't pull the trigger, and a solution was found, for me to see the seriousness of what could happen with raising an adolescent boy. Now, with girls, what happened was when, in Birmingham, for the first time, we came face to face with what are called eating disorders. These are the bane of white, upper-middle-class Americans. They do not tend to be among so-called blue-collar girls. There are other things going on there. And I'm not some pundit. I'm simply talking out of my own personal experience. But in upper-middle-class, suburban, white situations, this is the disease which reaches into 8 out of 10 families who have adolescent girls. And when I became aware that one of the children in our parish, lovely family, lovely people, very committed Christian people, and very dear and unneurotic people, had a child who was actually looked like an IRA hunger striker, and actually almost died. And she was next to some young girls who did die at a hospital specifically devoted for this, and many of our hospitals here, even now, have wings where young girls with eating disorders go. I began to realize the extent of the malaise of adolescence. So on the one hand, we saw eating disorders that were lethal, that were like a disease. There was no expectation of it. The child had been a lovely, dear, open, gregarious little girl, and yet suddenly something seemed to pitch over when she was about 13. It had a lot to do with peers, and this pattern entered into in which children at times actually treat themselves so badly that they do not recover. So this came to me, Mary, as a, this is very serious, because teenagers have no idea that they could die, that they have no practical idea at all that they could end up dying through an action or through some driving thing or through an eating disorder. So this alerted us to the seriousness of this particular issue. Now I want to talk a little bit about grace with teenagers and what we've seen work and what it's all about. The number one thing, and I'm going to talk about the Bible, I'm going to talk about forgiveness, but the number one thing that you have to understand about the teenagers is that they require a father. The father is more important than the mother. This is an idea that immediately gets resistance from mothers. But in fact, this is the great narcissistic shock to women who are raising adolescent boys and girls, because in the early years, the mother is the most important. She is more important than the father. The father's role with the mother, when you have little children, is for him to support and help the mother. Now, many of you don't have husbands who've done that, or some of you were husbands who didn't do it, but nonetheless, and I speak as one. But the point is, the role of the father when the children are little is to support and help and spell the mother. That's the role of the father. A two-year-old is not going to relate to the father for the most part. He wants his mother. However, when puberty comes, it completely changes, and it's one of the great shocks of raising kids. Because the mother, who is typically heavily invested in the child, suddenly finds that she has in fact become the bad guy. And she is no longer the one that the child wants in the teenage years. But the child wants the father. This is totally true of boys. Boys are not that interested about their mother coming to their games. Matter of fact, they're a little embarrassed. They are not that needy of the physical and emotional support of their mothers after they're about 13, 14, or 15. What they want is their fathers. And the great lesson of raising teenagers, the mother has to come to the very sort of sad realization that her time is up. It will come back in another way later, but dad is crucial, and this is why divorce in the teenage years is so terribly deleterious, because the child wants the father. Similarly with the girl. The girl, now you're going to say, well, these are just Paul's opinions. Well, they are, but I've had so much experience that I can look at you with total confidence believing that what I'm saying is true. It's not me. And I'll apply it to faith in a minute. But girls need their fathers because the girl needs to be touched and embraced physically by the father. If the girl is not, obviously appropriately in this highly paranoid age, but if the girl child is properly shown physical affection from the father, it is an enormous deterrent against looking for physical affection in other ways with the wrong kind of man. And those of you who have seen it with your husbands, your own fathers, your own children, there's nothing like a father who has a physically affectionate relationship with his daughter. It makes such a difference in regarding that part of life which is most central, male-female relationships, that daughters who have fathers who are physically affectionate are a rare and very blessed breed. Similarly, boys who have fathers who are right with them in the adolescent years have a gift that will never stop giving. So I want to say that the worst thing that you can do in raising teenagers is for the father to be emotionally or physically absent. Obviously, the father sometimes has to be physically absent, right? You get on an airplane. But for a father to be absent emotionally and physically is death. It's a wound that the child will never get over. You may know about this in your own life with your own dad. Similarly, and this is where the mother has to make this very threatening shift to support the father in his relationship with the children during those key years, just as the father needed to be number two to the mother during the little girl year, little boy and little girl's years. I'm going to read a quote from T.S. Eliot's third great play. You know, he wrote four plays. The family reunion, actually Murder in the Cathedral, which I think is a little, not very good, but many like it. Then he wrote five. Then he wrote The Family Reunion. Then he wrote The Cocktail Party, which is great, his great masterpiece of psychic Christian penetration. And then he wrote The Confidential Clerk, which is a kind of comedy, but it's very deep. And he closed out his career with a play called The Elder Statesman. And these are full of great wisdom. But in this play, which is all about a young man finding out who his father is and isn't. A young man finding out who his father is and isn't. He has this beautiful son speaks to his father. He's an English noble and says to his father, this is in poetry, the following. There's something lacking, he says to his father, between you and me, that you had, and have, and always will have, with your own father. Now he's speaking of the man he's talking to. He says, you, my father, had something that I never had, because you had a good relationship with my grandfather, your father. And then the young boy goes on like this. The father who was missing in the years of childhood, those years have gone forever. The empty years. Oh, I'm terribly sorry to be saying this, sir. But then Sir Claude says, it's my own fault. Let me repeat that again. The father who was missing in the years of childhood, those years have gone forever. The empty years. And then he continues talking to his father. Oh, I'm so terribly sorry to be saying this, sir. What that means is that if there is an absent father, whether it's your father who is absent, or whether you have been the absent father for your own children, you can never recover from that. I'm just trying to tell you, it's a sad fact. There is no way to recover from it. It's a wound that can never be recovered. It can be talked about, it can be lovingly dealt with in certain ways, and it can be, as it were, in certain ways dealt with a little bit, but it will never be solved. If the father was absent in the key years, there is no way that a father can make it up in the later years, except in a kind of grandiose gesture. So it's just a fact you have to come to terms with. If you were absent for your children when they needed you as young teenagers, that wound can never be, you can never redo that. This is why your relation with your teenage sons and daughters is really important. If you miss the opportunity when they're 12 to 14, it will never return. Because once they're 16 and 17, certain bad feelings, certain bitternesses, certain memories will have been set. And once they're in their 30s, there's nothing you can do about it. And similarly, if you know, I've never yet visited a person dying in the hospital who wanted to talk about football. Isn't that interesting? Never, ever, once have I visited even the most determined Clemson fans or Auburn fans. When they're actually in the ICU, I have yet to have one of them ask me about football. But I've very often had men say this, I wish I'd been around more when my children were little. And that's just a fact. The power of the Eliot's quote is that he accepts it. You know, you can't, in that sense, replay it. You have to sort of come to terms with it. The best thing you can do is when you have the chance, give your children everything, especially in the teenage years. Now, what have I said? I've said that original sin is evenly distributed. Teenagers are in incredible fluid identities. It very much irks me in freshmen when they go into freshman year, wherever they go, and they have all these identity fairs, you know, are you gay? Think you're gay? You know, are you black? Well, have you considered whether you're really ADD? I mean, they plant all these seeds in you. That may be true, they may be not, but teenagers don't know anything. They suspect certain things about themselves, but it's all mixed up. If you've raised a teenager, it's all mixed up. And do not think that their identity is anywhere near as established as they think. So you have a role to play. Secondly, the father is the key bearer of grace to adolescent girls and adolescent boys. And if there's an absent father, it's just something that can never be recovered and has to be mourned, properly mourned for the rest of your life. You know, I was very mean to one of my children once. He was about 11, and he came in, and he was an underachiever. And he brought home a report card, which was way below what he could do. He was 11 years old. And it was one of those things that you look back upon all your life. I'm sure you've had moments like that. I let him have it. I was so upset at this child's underachieving report card that I just lost it. And I got a little truculent. You know how sometimes a father can be? I sort of didn't let it go. And I hammered at him, and finally he just burst into tears and put his hands over his head. He was already wearing black, you know, at that age. And of course the next day he was wearing black. But I've often tried to, it's sort of a joke in our family, that every time I see him now, and he's now in his late 20s and is a very happy person, every time I see him I say, have you forgiven me for what happened when you were 11? Oh, Dad. Because it's a great burden to me. Now, he has forgiven me, but nonetheless, these things have enormous implications when you're at that kind of an age, when there's tremendous impressionability. Now, I want to say something else about your children, and then something else. Now, I wrote about this question of teenage children in my book last year that came out on grace, and I want to read one sentence. The thing about children is that they are begging for you to lay down the law so that they can break it. They are dying for you to lay down the law, to be non-permissive, so they can break it. And this is what I wrote in this book that came out last year. On the surface, adolescents are asking for the law precisely so they can break it. At a deeper level, adolescents are asking for grace again and again so that they can return to the love that always gives thanks. At a deeper level, they're asking for grace again and again. If you do not understand this as a parent, you will sink below the waves. You have to understand that children are dying for you to exercise what the world calls tough love so they can go out and act out. They are dying for you to talk about responsibility and accountability and all the words that we hear, precisely so they can go out and be irresponsible and unaccountable and terrible. So I'm very eager to invite you to lay off all attempts at responsibility, accountability, heavy-duty sort of disciplines and rules that you think will sort them out. Occasionally, you have to ground your child for 2 years. Yes. Occasionally, you have to be willing for them to be arrested. And you have to pray that they'll be arrested. And twice in our life, we prayed that two of our children would get arrested. And once our prayer was answered. And that was very, very helpful. It helped us in just 2 nights in a jail does a great deal for a child. And a 6 months in a jail is the best thing that could possibly happen to them. But what I want to really get you off the whole idea of sort of boundaries and accountability and talking about responsibility and exhorting their superego. You see, what you're constantly doing is you're a parent gets into a gruesome, twosome alliance with their superego. right? Their superego is thou shalt not. And if you play into their superego, the nasty part just explodes with power. So that's why you have to get in touch. All parents don't understand that they are becoming identified with the superego. And the moment you do, you're, I know this is difficult material, two people have walked out now already, that it has to be more with cell phones. If you allow yourself to get enmeshed with their superego, like your father and I, you know, don't you see what you're doing? You've got to this. If you don't do that, that will happen. You are their id, or their inner rebellious streak, is going to have a field day. Look how it was with you. The best way for you to understand this is, how did you relate to your parents? Let me tell you, not good, someone in the back said. Have you all read this week's cover story on New York Magazine? You must read it. It's a cover story, I think it's actually last Friday's New York Magazine, and a study at Penn State has conclusively proven that 98% of all teenagers lie all the time to their parents. Isn't that fascinating? And it doesn't have anything to do with race, or sex, or ethnicity, or socioeconomic background. It was proven, and people are quite amused by it, of course. We knew it already. We learned it long ago. But 98% of teenage children lie to their parents. They lie about where they're going. They lie about who they're going with. They lie about what they're going to do when they get there. They lie about what movie they saw at the multiplex. They lie about whether there was a chaperone at the after party. They lie about how they got home. They lie about when they got home. They lie about when they went to school. They lie about whether they did their homework. What are some of the other things that they lie about? Did you read the article? What clothes
they wear when they're outside of the house.
Yeah, they lie about what clothes they wear when they're outside of the house. What are some of the other things that the statistic was? What they ate for lunch. They are programmed to lie to their parents. And the statistics, 98% of teenagers are lying. And they're specifically, the whole point is to lie to you. It's not to lie to their friends. It's to lie to you. Because you're the only person that has any impact on, you see. So that being the case, all the talk about accountability, if you sort of get involved with their superego, you're going to get lumped in. And so what am I saying? Well, I'm really basically saying redemption occurs after the acting out. There's almost nothing you can do to prevent a teenager from acting out. The parenting occurs after they have acted out. That is the great shock. The law says straighten your kids out before they act out so they won't act out. Grace says your children are going to act out in some form. Pray for them that they will not lose a right arm or a leg or be paralyzed. Pray for them. But when they do act out, that's when the love of a parent truly comes into its own. Now, I want to give you an example of this, and then two other examples, and then I'm finished. The passage from the Bible that I think is really helpful here is this. It's chapter 15 of St. Luke. Jesus told them a parable. What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? And when he has found his lost sheep, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost. Just so I tell you, there is more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 goody-two-shoes who are lying anyway, who need no repentance. Let me repeat that. That's a free translation. There is more joy in heaven over the child you produced that got arrested and has been in rehab who repents than over 99 straight arrows, who really weren't straight arrows, who, quote, need no repentance. And this is why I've taken as my text tomorrow night when I preach at the institution service here, the prodigal son. I'd asked Marcia to read from the prodigal son. So if you think that you can prevent the child from acting out by any kind of legislation or limits or criticisms, I wish you luck. I hope it works. My experience with my own self has taught me that it is an absolutely lost cause, although you mean well. You mean well, I understand that. Your great issue is going to become after they act out. Now let me give you three illustrations and then I'll open it up to you. This is a classic case. There was a very devout evangelical Christian family that I knew. Very, very devout. Lovely people. Really dear, and couldn't have been more sincere, and they were not on the sort of psychotic line. Bill is assuring me that he's not walking out, and I knew he wasn't walking out. And they were having dinner one night. I knew this family very well. They were really nice people, and the children were great. And the mother and the daughter started having an argument at the dinner table. And finally, the daughter, and she was 16, she hauled off and called her mother an extremely vulgar name. And the two other little boys, the little brothers, the father, I mean, in this family, at dinner time, for the daughter who was 16 to haul off and call her mother a really ugly, very vulgar name, the word of which they had never heard before in that house publicly, was such a shock. The mother just lost it completely, ran out of the room, and just burst into tears, and there was a deathly silence around the table. Now, have you all ever been in a situation like that? Well, at least Mary and I obviously aren't, because I'm in the ministry, so we don't have problems with our children. it's one of the wonderful things about becoming a Christian. After you become a Christian, you have no more problems. But the father did an amazing thing. He stopped the father, and because the girl herself was shocked that she said it. And he said to her something like this, "You know, honey, I don't think you realize that your mother's been under a lot of pressure recently. You may not realize that this is going on, and this is going on, and this is going on. And I don't think you have any idea what your mother's really going through just now. And did you have any idea when she acted that way?" And then he said that. And of course the daughter was thrown, completely thrown. But the father's equanimity is not immediately sending her to her room. He's not immediately blowing up and having her hide or being very, very conscience-stricken and using heavy language. He wasn't being a pushover. These were devout Christian people. They go to church. They're serious Presbyterians. And by the way, do you know that the word Presbyterian has exactly the same letters and the same number of letters as the word Britney Spears? Did you know that? Yes, I guarantee you. Go home and write Britney Spears. And Britney Spears has the exact same letters and the same number as the word Presbyterians. I kid you not. Now, what he did, though, he was actually very, the father was called upon to defend the mother. He wasn't defending the daughter. He was defending the mother to put a little bit of rational conversation into it. And the long and the short of it is there was a very real and tearful apology that was quite sincere that came about 2 or 3 days later, and the family was immeasurably strengthened by the father immediately not just coming in, you know, "You can't use that kind of language with your mother. Do you know how much trouble you are, you little puppy? You know, you are not going to be getting to that Camaro for the next 6 years. I don't care. And that young man you've been dating, we didn't like him anyway. He is not, you know," all those sorts of things that happened in West Craven movies, like "I Know What You Did Last Summer." None of it. He had a feeling for what was called for. Now, I want to tell you two final stories, and then I'll put it up, and I'll ask Mary if she has anything to say. This is how, these are happy endings of raising teenage children. Now, raise your hand, but don't, just in your heart, if you've ever had to mother or father a real piece of work. Just in your heart. A child who's a real piece of work. A son or a daughter who's a real piece of work. Or maybe you were that real piece of work. Just raise your hand, in your head. Now, this is what I noticed. A daughter I knew who was had a terrible time with her mother, and the father didn't handle it very well, and she kept getting involved with a succession of unacceptable men, the wrong kind of men, one after another, they all looked like Billy Joel on a really bad day, and she was not from that kind of background at all, and it was one after another, and she was just terrible and awful, but her parents did actually continue to love her, and they did not just rule her out or disinherit her or have horrible words, but they were patient, prayerful, and they just felt deep down that if they just hung in there with this child, eventually she would find her way. Interestingly enough, she did, but not till she was 34 years old. And sometimes you have to have a long wait. You know what happened? She got married to an okay guy, and she had children of her own. And as soon as she had these two little children of her own, she was not a fundamentally, actually, I was always very sympathetic to her because her mom was so overbearing. Her mom was so incredibly controlling, and the father was so kind of undone by the whole thing. I was sort of, in my sinful self, kind of hoping she'd really move to California. I'm just kidding. I would never say that publicly. But she, when she actually had children, she developed a kind of compassion for her mother. You know how sometimes you say you don't really understand how much your parents love you until you have children of your own? Well, this happened. And this young girl, who by that time had as many tattoos as I have fingers and toes, once she had a second child, and her husband wasn't all that terrible, there was a healing based upon the common... She understood her mother when she had children of her own. And in fact, that family is close again. They had to wait a while, but they are. Another case was the... I'll read this story, because I quoted the story in my book, and I say it better than I did it there. This fellow was the worst nightmare of any possible parents. He was arrested, and he, like many of your children, he became involved in an addictive substance. Many of you have had children who have become involved in a drugs or alcohol. And this fellow went the full nine yards, and he was in rehab, and it was just unbelievable. But thank God they supported him in rehab. And about in his late 20s, I'll never forget, he came home with this girl to his parents who had never stopped loving him and had never written him off and just had basically agreed to let him go psychodynamically for a while. And he came back and he said, "Mom and Dad, I want you to meet Martha. We met in rehab. And guess what? We want to get married. And guess what? We want Mr. Zoll to do it at St. James Episcopal Church." I mean, it has nothing to do with me. It has to do with symbolism. So here this incredibly troubled young man goes to rehab, meets the girl, who in fact is perfect, and even Mom, we want to get married in church. Now, you'd be amazed how many children don't want to get married in church. But this was an amazing thing, and I realized that the parents involved had not succumbed to either pressure or guilt, but they'd sort of been, in a way, been willing to sort of let their children go. And this is very rare. And in doing so, they had finally given the children the permission to crack up. Always pray that your children will have their nervous breakdown early. It's really crucial. Remember what I said. Always pray that your children will have their breakdown early. Because the earlier they have it, the more likely they are they're going to find the hope that they need. If they have it in their 40s, it's very, very tough. Well, those are a few thoughts. The greatest thing I can say about raising teenagers is that the Christian hope for teenagers comes after they've acted out, not before. If you think your job is to prevent your daughter from acting out, you are dealing from the law, the command. If you are deeply helpful when they have cracked up, then you're operating from grace. And that is what they will never forget. And that will be the thing that will, in fact, draw them back to your life. Thank you for listening. Mary, I'm sure I've left out something. Do you want to just say anything at all? Just come up here from our long and painful experience of raising adolescents. Would you speak into the microphone? If you don't have anything to say, we can just watch Return of Dracula again.
Something at the top. Just that whole thing of not... when children are little, you really do spend your life rescuing them. And that's your job, to rescue them, to keep them safe. And it's a counterintuitive thing at a certain point to not rescue your children. And you, it's hard to, only prayer and the Holy Spirit can tell you when to rescue and when not to. There's no formula for that. But there are times when I do believe you have to let them fail or let them learn, really let them play out the where they're headed. Because if you don't do that, you're really getting in the way of what God is trying to do with them. You don't want your children to turn into little Pharisees who think they can be good. You don't, because they'll be insufferable. And they won't be loving, and they won't really engender love. So you want them to learn something about their own weaknesses and their own need for a savior, for starts, but also their own, just their own need, so that they're, they all need to be saved, even if they're good. So that just, I just underline what, I mean, Paul said that, but non-rescuing.
Can you give an example in our life without being overly personal?
Well, yes, we have one of our children has really put us through, we could give examples of everything with this, I can say him, because we only have him. But there was a girlfriend that he had, that, and they wanted to, and we knew she was not right, and we didn't approve of their, the sort of relationship they had, and we just knew that if we came on heavy and said what we really thought about their relationship, it wasn't so much about her, but it was about, they were, it was a need thing going on, and they were kind of a reason to them. And we just didn't say anything. We really, for some reason, and this child remembers my going, driving him to the airport once, and he was talking about moving to Boston and moving in with this girl. And I said, well, and this is what Paul means by not appealing to the superego and saying what I think you should do. But I said to him,
what I didn't say,
tell him what to do or what I thought. But what I did say, he said he wanted to move in with this girlfriend. This is what they were planning. And he said, Mom, what do you think? And I said, well, I'm sure you will come to the right conclusion. I'm sure the two of you will work out what is the right answer here. I believe you will. I mean, did I believe it? I don't know. But I was appealing. I knew that the other wasn't going to work. I knew it was going to throw him right into her arms and a long saga that would end badly. You know, I knew that. I had no wisdom to know that. So, coming on and telling him what I really thought and why they shouldn't do this and blah, 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 was not going to help. But I just said, I'm sure you'll make the right decision about this because, I really believe you will figure this out and you will know what is the right thing to do. And he still looks back on that. He said, I can't believe you didn't say what you thought. How did you not say what you were really thinking? And sure enough, they broke up within weeks. I mean, that's really true. They broke up within weeks. So that's sort of an example. But that's what Paul means by not appealing to the superego, but appealing to the ego that's trying to emerge in a healthy way. Ego is a healthy word, meaning the real self, the real adult self. So appealing to that worked in that situation. Now, there are other times with that same child when we could see that he was absolutely drowning and that there was nothing he could do to help himself and that we had to intervene and get him to a place where he could then function and begin to make any kinds of decisions. So there, I mean, we went to New York one weekend and cleaned up his apartment because it was such a mess and it was so depressing for him. And we knew he was not going to be able to do it. And he was paralyzed. And those passages about paralyzing are very helpful with children.
In the Bible?
In the Bible. Oh, yeah. I find them very helpful. That he comes to the paralyzed. He has compassion for the paralyzed. And there was, that was a different approach. But that, and he sees that as being graceful as well. Because we didn't judge him for that mess that he was in. We just said, we're coming to help you. Get out of this. I mean, get to a place where you can make some decisions. So there's no formula, I guess is what I'm saying.
The point, now we're open for some questions. The point is allowing your child to bottom. Allowing your child to bottom, which is a truly remarkable counterintuitive labor of love. And yet there are times, sometimes, when you have to overcome your fear and help them in a paralyzed situation. But and the fact that most of what is involved with teenagers will come back later on when they say, I can't believe you did that or you didn't do that. But any attempt to try to legislate a teenager's life is bound in 100% of cases to backfire. Say one other thing and then we'll take it.
Well, just one thing that Paul has said, but it's really true. Whatever they're doing as far as acting out is for the benefit of only two people in the world, the mother and dad. It's not aimed at anybody else. Just remember that. Whatever they're doing, that's who it's for. It's true.
I agree. Okay. Any comments? Kate, and then Walter.
Can
we have clean up your house? Thank you for that comment. Well, sometimes what happens, maybe you've seen this with, I don't know if any of you have mothers who are bag ladies, any of you ever had a pack rat person in your house, maybe your mother or you, and they get to the point when there's so many newspapers and so many old editions of the Evening Star, and everything's in, believe me, there are people right around here who have this problem, and they're so completely underwater that they can't really even begin, so sometimes you do have to go over and just make a move. But we have Walter and then Randy. Walter.
Consider children, aren't they the same commandments?
Aren't the Ten Commandments form expressions of the law? Oh, absolutely.
In other words, you have to impose death rather than say, well, let's see what they do. If they steal, then we'll forgive them. It doesn't seem to be concerned about that.
Well, I want to say this about that. Yes, we teach our children the Ten Commandments, absolutely. But St. Paul said that the law is written in the heart. And what you often find is people don't really need to be told that they're doing something wrong because they deep down know it. Your children don't really have to be told that they're doing wrong. They know it. They actually, and the world is telling them, because again, St. Paul said, oh man, it's like an umpire in you. You have a monitor in you all the time who's speaking. Don't you have a part of you who's always telling you you're not pretty, or you're not tall enough, or you're just a bag of whatever, or you're mean, or you're avaricious? I mean, we all have these things. So I tend to want to say that the law exists in the heart. Although, believe me, the Ten Commandments are true. Absolutely. But guilt is so ubiquitous. Guilt in people is so ubiquitous. And anybody here who's a type A knows about it. I mean, the guilt that we have is unbelievable. Now, there was a... Thank you for that, Bill Wolfer. And then Randy, and then Gerard.
When you're talking about the kids acting out, is that essentially them wanting to get that emotional love from you, the grace from you? Is there a subliminal...
Yes, they're desperate to do bad so that they can test whether they are actually loved. And that's why this really comes out when they're divorced. If you have a child who gets divorced, or a child who has an abortion, or a child who gets arrested for drug trafficking, that's the time when the rubber really hits the road. They are desperate to know that you're there for them. And very often you're not, because you're so upset and you're so angry. Or embarrassed. Who wants their child's name in the front of the paper? You have an opportunity to do that, but what do you mean by little things earlier?
Well,
Yes, smaller infractions are much better. So remember, ever, you know, the Berenstain Bears? The Berenstain Bears, it's all about small infractions. Brother Bear threw something at sister and he broke a beautiful lamp. And then he lied to his mother about who broke it. That's the sort of thing. Small infractions. To actually forgive your child in a small infraction, you lay the foundation. Thank you for that, Catherine. Now, Gerard and then Zara. Yes. You broke most of the laws. You were also good at not getting caught. Your question was, is there a point about the, it was really the woman taken in adultery who was going to be stoned, and he said to her, well, neither do I forgive you. Go and sin no more. Well, there is never a point, in my view, when you say to a teenager, okay, I forgive you, now just don't do it again. Because, let me say why that's true. Because in the gospel, and many people don't understand this initially, although they understand it instinctively, when you are really forgiven, you don't do it again. I mean, you may do it once again, but when you are really absolved of something that you've done that is terrible, generally speaking, you don't immediately go out and do it again, because the power of that is so great. So I think what Jesus was meaning there, it was a description. I forgive you, and you know what? I'd be very surprised if you ever do it again. That's why the story, that the great example of literature is the opening scene of Les Miserables by Victor Hugo. Les Miserables, when a guy on a recently released criminal steals a bishop's candlesticks. And when he's caught, the bishop gets him off the hook by telling the police that he'd given them to the man. The man is totally forgiven of this crime that he's done. And it is the great change. It changes this man forever and ever and ever. So I never say to somebody, I forgive you, but by the way, I'm hoping that you won't do it again. Because to me, that's Indian giving. It's conditional. You're giving on the with a condition attached. I want to say that unconditional loving. I'm going to sound like Greenweaver. You know what I mean? I always feel like I'm some kind of minister in Wayne's World when I start talking this way. But when you attach a condition to love, even if you imply it, you've immediately set the stage for a thought to come into the person's head. So that's my view on that. But I take a strong line on that. And a lot of Christians think I'm antinomian, that somehow I'm blessing sin because I believe in forgiveness. Big question. Were there any other comments or thoughts? Zara and then Catherine. Mary, probably wasn't a very good answer. Do you want to add to what I said?
I think
I'm going to win, Gerard, here.
There's always fear.
There's always fear that what? Yes, it's always clear that if I forgive you, you'll do it again, right? So it's a faith issue. Oh my gosh. Zara. Why does James Dobson have such a large following? Because there are a tremendous number of people who want to be children in their understanding of Christianity and believe that Christianity is about control rather than grace. His following is rapidly diminishing, and he will be a completely discredited character in the next 10 years. His books will never be read in about 5 years from now. That's a strong statement, but I would absolutely so, because he believes that Christianity is about control. Christianity is, in fact, the end of control. And that's what makes the position of grace so antithetical with Dr. Dobson. It's just, again, if you've ever tried Dr. Dobson's methods, and maybe you have, they always result in teenagers who become car hijackers and terrorists. Sorry, Mary, you don't think I should talk about that. I'm being too strong. What would you have said to her question? Go ahead.
Well, I think
God bless them. If it works, it works. But I just find a lot of that teaching very full of Pharisaism. You see, remember, what is the thing, let me put it another way, who are the people that Jesus was most, did he ever really criticize any one group of people? Yes, he only criticized one group of people in his entire ministry. Who were they? The Pharisees. The Pharisees. He only reserved his words of judgment for Pharisees. And those were the people who had these heavy judgments. And so I think that's something important to look at. I forgive my attitude towards James Dobson. I was probably totally wrong in what I said. Catherine. Well, I wrote an article for his paper just 2 years ago, and one of my dearest youth group people from Birmingham works full-time for him right now. I certainly think I know a lot about him. I happen to disagree with him, okay? But I'm sure he's sincere in what he does. He will definitely lose the next election for whoever he happens to endorse. Yes? What did Mary say? It's not important. Ask her after this. We're going to do two more questions and then I'm done. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to do two things. I'm trying to help you understand that to say that any kind of attempt to control your teenager will be an alliance with the forces of the law that always create a doubling of sin or rebellion. And this is an empirical fact. Any of you who have been teenaging have them know this is true. So I'm trying to say, if you think that you can control your children to get them not to do something, it's failed. It will not work. However, the great issue for a mother or father of a teenager is how you deal with them when they have the car accident. That's the issue. When they get caught cheating, when they get caught in a lie, that is when the parenting as a Christian enters its maximal phase. And that's what I'm really trying to say. And what will happen is, just like in all of Christianity, you never can control the upshot. You can only work retrospectively with the damage. And that's why, for example, if I preached about premarital sex, let's imagine I did. I would simply increase the amount of premarital sex by 50% in the whole congregation in 5 minutes, and then everyone, no one would ever come to me. If I preach about forgiveness, obviously I don't believe in premarital sex. I believe what the Bible teaches is the best way forward. But if I preach forgiveness and absolution, someone might be able to come to me and say what they were really doing. And the trouble with teenagers is they're afraid to tell you what they're really up to because they're afraid you're going to judge them. So they don't tell mom what's happening. They don't tell the father what's happening because they're afraid they're going to get judged. And as a result, they carry this huge amount of hidden material that is just killing them. And I'm trying to offer a situation where the grace will produce a transparency. And that is the great thing with a teenage child. But remember that 98% of your children lie to you, according to Penn State University thing. And also remember this, and I've done youth work for many years as I am alive in this world almost. What your children get into is always at least twice as bad as you know. Believe me, any of you who actually have found out what your children got up to, because look at you. Look at you. What you did when you were young was at least twice as bad as what your parents knew. And what your children do is at least twice as bad. When you realize that, it's very freeing. What, Nick? I couldn't hear. Oh, a key thing, and I'm going to get back to you, Catherine, and then also... three other questions. A key thing about raising children, especially for the father, is a sense of humor. Absolutely crucial, especially with the boys, but with everybody. If you're serious about your parenting, there's nothing like being able to laugh with your children. For us, it's been the absolute saving. People say, well, Paul, how come your children turned out so well? And they do. They say that. And I said, and what did you do? And I always say, nothing. I did nothing. The secret was we did nothing. We didn't give them any instructions at all. We did, however, laugh a lot. And behind the scenes, Mary and I were on our knees. Okay, two more final questions. Catherine, and then maybe Mary and Hallie, maybe. Yes?
I just want to clarify. So when the kids are smaller, little, you set up the boundaries. And then by the time they get... probably 11, 12, and kind of let them work through what they desire to do, but I can't read it all.
Oh, Colin, that's a very good question. Mary, will you answer that? Okay. The only boundaries you should ever set for children are things that relate to their physical safety. The only boundaries are those, like, you know, I'm like watching them when they're near a swimming pool. No other boundaries. No other boundaries. Because all those boundaries will get linked in their minds with guilt. But making sure they don't go into the, they're watched after the beach, that's a total. But that goes back to a distinction in theology between the first and the second use of the law. I don't want to get into all that. But there's a no-brainer use of the law, which is about boundaries. But if it's attached to guilt, even when they're three, you're on the wrong team. Because you're going to get linked up with that superego. We were talking to a young man, and he was saying, you know, I'm just so upset at my girlfriend. She has this overly close relationship to her father. And her father just is way too important. And he's sort of threatening me. So I constantly say, will you stop being so close to your father? And I said to this young man, well, how's it going? Is that helping? What you've done there, you have immediately become associated with her superego. She knows that she's very close to her father. You need to support her in her adult ego self, not in her lecturing self. And that was a whole new idea. So instead of constantly attacking her father in her presence, he began to sort of come up to her emotionally in her own normality, and the pressure began to go down. Anyway, yes, ma'am.
Father, the absent father,
never be forgiven. Did I say that? Never be forgiven? Well, that was too strong. No, I agree. Thank you very much for saying that. I misstated that. What I would say about it is, but I've run into this all the time, you see. I'm constantly running into people whose fathers were not present in their childhood years, and they're very bitter. I mean, this is, as you know, this happened. What I would say was, yes, the father can ask forgiveness and be forgiven. Like, I had to ask forgiveness for jumping on my son in a very, very bald and terrible way. Yes, the father can be forgiven, but the pathos is you can never relive those years. That's all I'm saying. Yes. Wait, Hallie? I hear that. Of course you can be forgiven, just as I am always praying to be forgiven for certain ways that I acted towards one of my children, which I will carry with me to my grave. That is, I was too hard. But what I do, so I'm asking to be forgiven, but I'm also aware that if you miss those years can never be recovered in a human sense. That's all I'm saying. Hugely significant. Hugely significant to be able to forgive oneself as a father. But for me, God has helped a little bit there. I've had, remember that song in Tender Mercies with Robert Duvall? It was on last night on the Retroplex. And he says, well now, honey, here's a song I've written. It's called If God Can Forgive Me, Why Can't You? And I think that's very much relevant to what you're saying. Hallie, and then I think we'll close. You mean if you have a straight arrow child who needs a little bit of acting out as opposed to your acting out child? Well, see, that's what happened. Remember, listen, you understand what you're saying? But she says, what about you have one child who's the quote nun or whatever, and then you have the other child who's, all over the ballyard. What you understand, this totally confirms everything I'm saying. The Bible says that the number one agency of human trouble is the law. Because the law makes you either try to be good, and then you become a hypocrite and a Pharisee, or to chuck it and go to New York and go into the underground. Right? Those are the two ways. So many of your families have had this. I mean, have you ever had this in your family? You have one child who is bad, and the other child who is good. Now, what I would say is, interestingly enough, because everybody's really the same, remember what T.S. Eliot said, all cases are unique, yet oddly similar. I have found that even Pharisees actually do act out, but they just don't tell you. There's a lot of Pharisees out there who act out, but they just don't tell you. And if you actually knew, you'd be quite surprised. Haven't you ever found out something about someone in your family that surprised you? You know, somebody who you thought was just perfect, and then you discovered something that shocked you about them? Well, similarly, sometimes people who act out horribly are a little better than you might think. Sometimes it turns out that they may have done a really lovely thing along with it. So, yeah, let Mary say something, and then we're done.
That's
it is complicated.
They don't get to experience grace.
Yeah, they don't.
I was an arrow. And I think
that. Did you say what?
I was an arrow.
You were a straight arrow.
Yeah. And I just really felt, probably as far as I know, that really, the reason I wasn't loved is because I'm always trying to make it before that wasn't true.
Yeah.
I never accepted that, so I never got to
pass
through.
Oh. Yeah, you have
I think the key with that situation, because I'm exactly what you're talking about as well, is creating a climate in which that child is full of judgment, self-judgment, and desperately needs to be able to tell the truth. And is so afraid of being found out. The grace is still what they need. And it's that they're just terrified that if somebody really knows them, they will be rejected and judged. And so you pray for opportunities to enable that child to tell you the truth. So it really has a lot to do with your relationship with them. And if they feel they can tell you the bad things as well as the good things, then they will experience that grace. But mostly what's going on, I think, inside that person is terrible fear of being found out. And putting up, you know, having a double life. And it's very serious.
Well, here's what you do. It's all told in the parable of the elder brother and the prodigal son. It's all in that story. Now it's time to end. I want to thank you all for coming. Let me just give you a preview. Last week we did male-female relationships. That's a minor topic. Today we did teenagers and adolescents. Next week I'm going to talk about raising little children. Now you may say, well, it's too late for me. I'm not fun. But it may not be too late for someone you know. The thing about raising little children, the great issue we'll talk about, is how the marriage suffers. Because when children are raised with over-investment, especially on the mother, the marriage becomes threatened. And we're going to talk about how when women of young children over-identify with their little children, they forget about hubby over here, and then they become extremely vulnerable to the other woman. And that is an absolutely frequent, classic thing that happens in life. And I really want to talk next week about the pitfalls and the joys of raising little children. And how is it possible to have boundaries for little children without destroying them forever? That is next week. I hope you'll come back and bring a parent of a little child. And just remember that 98% of your teenagers have lied to you today about a major thing. May the Lord bless our teenagers. Amen. Thank you.